I rolled into a truck stop at Shelby, Montana, which lies at the intersection of Interstate 15 and Highway 2. There is a mystique about Montana that attracts compulsive addictive wanderers like me, especially riders, and many of them had traveled to this very crossroads. John Steinbeck came through here with a pickup called Rocinante and a dog named Charlie. He was collecting thoughts for a book called Travels with Charlie. Robert Persig rode his motorcycle to Montana and wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And William Leastheat Moon, also known as William Trogdon, drove here in a Ford Econoline van which he called Ghost Dancer. His book was called Blue Highways. In 1960, John Steinbeck often encountered truckers and had many good things to say. To paraphrase Steinbeck, "I liked truckers very much, as I always liked specialists. Quite often I sat with these men and listened to their talk. By listening to them, I accumulated a vocabulary of the road. The great get-together symbol is the cup of coffee. I found I often stopped for coffee, not because I wanted it, but for a rest and a change from the rolling highway." William Trogdon, on the other hand, did not share Steinbeck's admiration for truckers. During his travels, Trogdon met working men from all walks of life, from farmers to engineers, and he always spoke of these men with great respect for their trades, with one exception, truck drivers. In 1980, William Trogdon stopped at this very truck stop and made these observations. "I seldom go into truck stops. When I hear Teamsters cant about being the self-professed sons of bitches of the highway, when I hear stories of retread shredding at 70, when I watch drivers trying to recuperate on coffee and chili, and look at faces, eyes bloodshot from pocket rockets, and witness their ludicrous attempts to be folk heroes, I get very nervous the next time I see one pushing 40 tons 70 miles an hour at me." As far as I was concerned, the self-righteous Mr. William Trogdon should have just kept driving right on past that truck stop and left the coffee and chili for the hard-working men who appreciated it. I took inventory of my nickels and dimes and dollars and found that I had less than $100, so I tried selling a few tapes and T-shirts, but there wasn't anyone around to buy them. Then I drove into town and parked Zelda under a railroad bridge just to get out of the sun. After rummaging around in the cabinets for something to eat, I heated a bowl of chili, poured it over some crushed Doritos, and smothered that in paste picante sauce. Good. Chili a la Gator. I was slumped on the back porch, eating my gruesome concoction and contemplating my finances when I noticed an old lady walking down the railroad tracks. She meandered along, hunched over, her face was drawn and weathered, and her clothes were ragged and torn. I suspected that it had been some time since she had had a meal as grand as the one I was enjoying. When she noticed me, I raised my hand in a friendly gesture, inviting her over for a bowl of gruel, but she quickly turned away. I wondered what kind of dreams she had when she was young. Was she a compulsive addictive wanderer, perhaps even a rider? Had she ridden these rails to exotic places? Anything was possible, but it appeared to me that the freight trains carrying her dreams had long since passed her by. I finished my chili and walked up the hill into downtown Shelby to find a copy shop and make some photocopies of my latest newsletter. I liked Shelby. It was a nice, clean town. The storefronts were full and the streets were busy. I couldn't find a copy shop, but someone suggested I go to the newspaper. The ladies at the newspaper were very helpful, and after making my copies, they let me sit at a desk to fold, address, and stamp the newsletters. We engaged in a friendly conversation about Zelda and my trip, but when I mentioned that I wanted to be a writer, the comment was met with a pregnant pause. Then one of the girls laughed and said, "You could stick around here and write all you want. Our reporter just left town." "That'd be great," I answered, but their response was a deafening silence. "I've spent the last week talking to people about the harvest. I could write a story right now." I offered again, but there was still no reply. They had been friendly right up to that point, kind of like you'd treat a stray dog. Pat it on the head, but don't take it home. My ego got the best of me, so I laid my business card on the counter and said, "Remember that name. The next time you see it, it'll be on the cover of a bestseller." I strolled down the street and came across the job service office. I paused for a moment, then made myself go inside. Bestseller, huh? Shit. Well, maybe someday, but right now the next John Steinbeck needed a real job. "Do you have any work around here, like a harvest crew or something?" The clerk marched over to the counter, licked his fingertips, and plucked several forms from a shelf. Fill out these forms, sign each one, and have a seat, he said. Having been self-employed most of my life and dabbling in various business ventures, I was no stranger to government red tape, and these forms were typical government dribble. It appeared to me that they were more interested in accumulating statistics than finding jobs, and I damn sure wasn't going to spend all afternoon filling out forms unless there was work available. I see there's no farm jobs up here, I said, staring at the bulletin board. Fill out the forms, sign each one, and have a seat. I could tell he'd recited that mantra 372,000 times. I studied the bulletin board closer. There were job postings for a mechanic at a car dealer, a clerk at the grocery store, and a police officer, but no one seemed to need a compulsive addictive wanderer who suffered from delusions of being a writer. I'm just passing through town. Aren't there any temporary jobs? Fill out the forms, sign each one, and I stormed out the door before he even finished. On impulse, I stopped at an ATM machine to see if I could get a cash advance. I stuck the card in the slot and punched in my PIN number. The machine ate my card and puked out a receipt that I could have sworn said, "Get a job, asshole." I plodded back down the hill towards Zelda and thought about the mess I'd made of my finances. It was a humbling experience to beg for jobs that paid less in a week than I was capable of making in a day. And all for what? What was so damned important about driving a stupid old truck across the continent? And what was this nonsense about being a writer? Damn. It was time to try cashing a reality check. Should I admit defeat, turn around, and go home? I thought about the old lady who had been walking the railroad tracks earlier. Perhaps she had never even tried to climb aboard that train of her dreams and had resolved herself to a lifetime of walking beside the empty tracks. That was a reality I wasn't willing to accept for myself. I climbed in Zelda and collapsed on the couch. Then I picked up the remote control and pushed the play button on the stereo. One of my demo tapes was still in the player, so the lyrics I heard just happened to be my very own words. There's no such thing as accidents and no such thing as coincidence. Everything happens for a reason, and changes come like the seasons. One door closes, one opens wide. Take a chance and step inside. Once you do, you'll realize that anything else was a compromise. Look inside and you will see all of your possibilities. You got a dream, it's time to face it. You got a dream, it's time to chase it. God'll give me everything I need. It's my duty to proceed. I will persist. I will succeed. I will persist. I will succeed. I will persist. I will succeed. I went back to the truck stop to get cleaned up and heard someone yell out, "Hey, Gator!" It was a couple of old Canadian truckers that I knew from years past. We sat and visited over a cup of coffee, and I asked them what sort of trouble I might run into crossing the border with my tapes and T-shirts. "Just tell them you're going straight to Alaska, eh? And you don't intend to leave anything in Canada. Seal your boxes and mark them for transport through Canada." I rolled into Sweetgrass, parked Zelda at the border, and walked over to Canadian Customs. I showed the officer a demo tape, a cap, and a T-shirt, and said, "I'm headed to Alaska, and I'd like to take these tapes and T-shirts with me. Can I just seal the boxes and mark them for transport through Canada?" "How many are there?" "I've got a dozen T-shirts and caps, but there's nearly 1,000 tapes." "That's a lot, eh? You can't bring that into Canada without paying duties." The officer handed me a booklet for importing commercial goods. There was page after page with headings like cargo control document, invoice, invoice recap, invoice cross-reference, tariff code, payment code, and mode of transportation. It was all typical government dribble. "What's the country of origin?" he asked, taking the cap and reading the label inside. "See this cap? It's not made in the U.S. It's made in Taiwan. Once you get through Canada, you'll have to pay duties to get it back into Alaska, eh?" "I suppose that means when I come back, I'll have to pay duties again, huh?" "In Canada, you will. If Canada isn't the country of origin, you take it out of the country and bring it back, you'll have to pay again, eh? I can't speak for the U.S., but I suspect it's the same. You better go back to U.S. Customs and ask them, eh?" I walked back to U.S. Customs and heard almost the same speech. They gave me another booklet with similar headings and a 30-minute lesson on importing and exporting, but it all boiled down to one thing. Sign there, pay here. I was required to report back to Canadian Customs, so I ambled back across the border. In the meantime, there had been a shift change. A new officer was on duty, and he wasn't satisfied with an abbreviated version of my saga. It took nearly 45 minutes to regurgitate every excruciating detail, at the end of which he asked incredulously, "Why don't you just seal the boxes and mark them for transport through Canada, eh?" He acted as though any idiot would have known that. I was dumbfounded. I'd spent nearly 2 hours haranguing over this, only to come full circle and return to my original plan. I considered the officer's suggestion, then turned him down. I was having visions of running into a dozen more officers between here and the Yukon, and each one having a different interpretation of the same laws. "I think I better leave everything in storage, but I'd like to take at least a few tapes." "How much are they worth?"
98 cents apiece, wholesale.
"No problem. Take 100 of them if you want, eh?" I rented a storage locker and stashed the balance of merchandise. I'd managed to get through the border, and all it cost me was a couple of hours and several thousand brain cells. But I considered myself lucky and put the ordeal behind me. However, I still had one minor problem. I was broke. I had less than $100 in my pocket, but I headed straight to a shopping mall in Lethbridge, Alberta. Not because I needed to relieve some stress by shopping. I went there because I knew there was a Sears store. I ran inside, slid my Discover card across the counter, and asked if I could get a cash advance. 10 minutes later, I walked out the door with $500 in my pocket. It bothered me to abuse my plastic fantastic credit card, but what the heck? It was my good credit, and I knew I'd pay it off. Eventually. Being a bum in the 90s has its conveniences. I reached Calgary that afternoon and headed straight for a place informally known as The Shop. While I was down in Montana, I met a Canadian trucker named Ray, and Canadian Ray suggested that I stop by. I pulled up at the shop and was greeted with a friendly round of hellos. Within minutes of my arrival, everyone seemed like old friends. A gray-haired trucker by the name of Earl insisted on pulling Zelda inside. Earl helped me service the truck and take care of a few minor repairs. We worked until the sun went down, then the tools were put away and the guitars came out. The shop also doubled as a rock and roll and roadhouse, and Earl was the acting manager, head mechanic, and lead guitar picker. He had a rich baritone voice that lent itself well to all the George Jones standards. Earl's daughter's name was Tammy, and she had once been a rodeo queen and barrel racer. Now she spent her time as a bookkeeper, homeopathic medicine woman, and horse whisperer. She also did a decent job of singing harmony and keeping up the rhythm on a flat-top guitar. One of the many truckers who stopped by was Ben. He was a classic cowboy with a black hat and bushy mustache. In the days before Ben started herding trucks for a living, he fronted his own country band and had a gravelly voice that was perfect for covering all the Haggard hits. Danny was another trucker whose heart was in the country, but could easily have taken his act to town with his bluesy electric guitar licks that were reminiscent of Eric Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Connie was an artist who stopped by the shop to apply her talents as a freehand sign painter. Her artwork was admired on trucks all over Canada, and she wasn't too hard to look at herself. In between coats of paint, Connie sat in with the boys and added colorful harmonies to the mixture. A guitar was passed over to me, and I was expected to pick a song and take my turn leading the jam session. My guitar skills were poor at best, and I couldn't recall the words to a single popular song. But I looked around at the room full of truckers and began strumming out the melody of a song I'd written called My Country Girl. The more skilled pickers easily filled in the background and covered for my mistakes. The glitter of Vegas fades out of my sight. The semi and I roll into the night. I think of the people who fall for the hype and think the pull of a handle will change their life. There's more to this life than turning a buck, whether you win it in Vegas or make it driving a truck. I spent my life chasing after dreams, girls in skin-tight jeans, and material things. I guess I've known my share of girls. Some were plastic and some were pearls. Some enjoyed breaking my heart, but you mended me right from the start. As the white line passes by me, I feel you here beside me. It's the dollar sign that makes me roam, but the memory of you keeps bringing me home. I'll travel all around this world, but I'll always come home to you, my country girl. All through the night, truckers and pickers and cowboys dropped by and sat in for a few minutes or a few hours, lending their own style to the jam session. We waltzed across Texas with Bob Wills, and we were running down the road with the Eagles. Then we sailed away to Margaritaville, but still managed to make Amarillo by morning.
Just as the sun began to lighten the eastern sky, the music began to fade. Although Earl had known me for less than 12 hours, he handed me the keys to the shop and headed home, so I got busy on some projects. The most important chore was to install another heater, because the small one under the dash did little to ward off the Canadian cold. After the heater was installed, I headed north out of Calgary on Highway 2, but then decided to head cross-country. I turned off the main highway at Red Deer and picked my way northwest on two-lane roads that wound through small farming communities like Rimby, Hoadley, Rocky Rapids, Drayton Valley, Entwistle, and Mayerthorpe. I'd hauled a lot of freight down these same roads over the years, and I never got tired of their pastoral charm. The first thing you notice about the villages are the tall wooden grain silos, neatly stacked in rows alongside the railroad tracks. Most of the silos are painted pastel green or burnt orange, and signs lettered high on their sides say Pioneer or Alberta Co-op. The farms that line the highway are usually well kept, with freshly painted houses and bright red barns. The crops that carpet the rolling hills are divided into neat, symmetrical patterns like enormous crazy quilts. I decided to spend a day in Whitecourt cleaning Zelda because she hadn't been washed for several weeks. I spiffed her up really nice before getting back out on the road, but I'd barely gone 5 miles before driving into a cloudburst. The rain didn't last long, but long enough to mix with the dust on the road, making an industrial-strength brown goo that affixed itself to Zelda. During the whole summer, I don't believe she was ever cleaned for more than 5 hours or 5 miles. Have you ever noticed that you can polish and shine a black truck until you're blue in the face? Then 5 minutes later, it needs washing again. But put on a clean black t-shirt and you can wear it for days, maybe even weeks before you notice it's gross. The opposite is true with white. Wash a white truck and it stays clean forever, but put on a clean white t-shirt and you look like a slob before lunchtime. I also noticed that I was getting a little dose of road fever. Road fever is a punchy feeling brought on by fatigue and loneliness, which is the direct result of spending too much time on the road. Some of the symptoms include obsessing over ridiculous notions, like washing black trucks, then drawing even more ridiculous conclusions about wearing white t-shirts. And worse yet, you tend to believe your observations are funny or clever. I wandered over hill and dale through communities with interesting names like Fox Creek, Little Smoky, Sturgeon Heights, and Crooked Creek. Crooked Creek, now that sounded like a place I could live. I could name a street after myself, so I'd live on Straight Street and Crooked Creek. Funny. I crossed over into British Columbia just on the other side of Dimmitt. That's Dimmitt, damn it. Then I passed through a burg called Tupper. Could this be where Tupperware was from? Clever. I was definitely developing a case of road fever. The next little town I stopped in was Little Poose Coop, not to be confused with Little Deuce Coop. In Little Poose Coop, there was a little laundromat. Inside the little laundromat, there were several little showers for rent. When I say little showers, I mean little. They were no more than tiny closets with coin-operated shower heads attached to the wall. This, however, was not a problem for me. I've learned to deal with such minor inconveniences because some truck stop showers aren't much larger than this one. First of all, I've learned not to take a gear bag into these claustrophobic enclosures. I always change into clean clothes in the truck after my shower. Therefore, I headed into the water closet carrying only a bar of soap, 4 quarters, and a towel. Getting undressed required a good deal of coordination. Since there was no place to sit, I had to do everything standing up. There was no room to bend over and take my boots off, so I had to balance on one foot while leaning over and pulling off the other. Perhaps this is why truck drivers are such good dancers. This also might explain why truck drivers are such good singers, because it helps to perform these maneuvers to music. The next trick was to get in and out of the shower without getting my dry clothes soaking wet. There were no hooks to hang anything on, so I had to take my clothes off, pitch them in the air, jump in the shower, then jump back out in time to catch the clothes before they landed in the puddle of water. I put a quarter in the slot, pitched my clothes in the air, jumped in the shower, and bolted right back out. This time, because the water was the approximate temperature of freshly melted snow. I stood waiting, naked, in the puddle of water, not wanting to use my towel, because it was no bigger than a dish towel and would only be good for one drying at best. I tested the water again, and it had risen to the temperature of iced tea. I checked it once more, and it was about as warm as a cold cup of coffee. I stepped back in the shower just as my quarter ran out. I climbed back out, dug around for another quarter, but my coins fell out of my pocket and rolled around on the floor. I managed to trap one with my toes, picked it up and put it in the coin slot, then climbed back in the shower again. I was singing the second verse of Kentucky Rain when the second quarter ran out. I stepped out again, retrieved my third quarter, and got back in with no difficulties. Now the water was about the temperature of a garden hose, and I was beginning to enjoy myself when my third quarter ran out. I stepped out of the shower, confident that I could pick up my last quarter and be back in before the chorus. Then terror struck. My last quarter had slid under the door. I dried off the remaining soap with the dish towel, got dressed, and was waiting outside for my laundry to dry, when I noticed two men carrying in dirty laundry from a pickup. The smaller of the two men was calm and collected, while the larger man seemed nervous and agitated. "You fellas been hunting?" I asked. "No, we're just driving down from Fairbanks," the smaller man replied. "I noticed your Texas plates. Thought you might be hunters." "No, I was working up in the oil patch in Alaska this summer, but I'm headed back to Texas now. My brother flew up last week so he could drive back with me and see the countryside." He gestured toward the large man who was thrashing about in the back of the pickup with a flashlight, obviously looking for something. "He looks mad," I chuckled. "Oh, he's always riled about something. He didn't think much of that old Alcan Highway. He prefers West Texas, where you can see 100 miles. The larger man came struggling through the door, lugging a big duffel bag. He was at least 6'6" and outweighed me by 40 pounds. He was holding up a shaving kit like a freshly killed trophy and said, "I finally found a goddamn thing." "I heard you didn't care much for the highway," I said. "I never got so damn sick of a goddamn road in all my life. They can take that some bitch and shove it." He hauled his oversized gear bag toward the tiny shower. "Budrow didn't care much for being cooped up in a pickup for 3 days," the man's brother confided. "He gets a little riled up when he's claustrophobic." "You think he's riled up now. Wait till he gets out of that shower." I eased up the highway to Dawson Creek before pulling into a roadside cafe and putting it to bed. It was well after dark, and even though I'd been on this road before, I didn't want to miss any scenery. The next morning I woke up and could see my breath rising out of the sleeping bag like smoke signals. I fired up the stove and put a coffee pot on, hoping the heat would help take the chill out of the air. After I had a cup of coffee and thawed out a bit, I got dressed and went for a stroll. I liked Dawson Creek. It was situated in a broad valley, completely surrounded by pasture lands and low mountains. Although the temperature was struggling to stay in the 30s, there was nothing above but clear blue skies. I decided to go in the cafe and have some breakfast while the sun warmed things up. Then I would unload the Harley and go for a ride. Even though I was layered up with long johns, a turtleneck, a heavy work shirt, a leather jacket, and gloves, I was freezing my bajungas off. There was a stiff wind coming out of the west, and combined with my ground speed, it created a wind chill of approximately 459 degrees below zero. I had to hunker down and breathe into my jacket because the cold air caused my esophagus to convulse, denying oxygen a passageway to my lungs. I fell in close behind a camper to break the wind. On the list of stupid things a guy can do, tailgating a camper on a motorcycle ranks right up there with kissing rattlesnakes and dancing with 5-time divorcees. Few survive either. I used the camper as a windbreak until I could catch my breath. Then I dropped back a ways until I was about to suffocate again. Then I closed the gap while gasping for air. The third time I closed the gap between my front tire and his bumper, the camper ran over a chunk of wood, which flew up and center-punched my front tire, then ricocheted off my shin. Chunks of 2x4s inflict considerably more pain than grasshoppers. The Harley wobbled a bit, but I quickly recovered and assumed a safer, albeit more frigid, distance. 65 miles of frozen hell was enough for this fair-weather rider. I pulled off at the town of Chetwynd and sought out the comforts of a cafe. I was sitting in the corner, making love to a hot cup of coffee and a cheeseburger, when a pickup with Alaska plates pulled up outside and parked next to my scooter. An older gentleman climbed out of the driver's seat and came inside the cafe. An attractive woman in her 30s exited the passenger side and walked around to where my bike was sitting. She slowly walked around the Harley, studying it from front to rear. Pausing at the rear, she stared at my license plate, then glanced up and down the street as though she were looking for the owner. Once inside the cafe, she looked around and spotted me in the corner. My windburned face and leather jacket gave me away as the rider. The gentleman she was with was at the counter ordering coffee and rolls, but she walked directly toward me with a warm, confident smile. "Is that your bike?" Her blue eyes sparkled. Yeah. My esophagus went into a spasm, just as it had done while riding in the ice-cold air. The cheeseburger was struggling to go down while my words were struggling to come up, and they met in a fiery head-on collision. Are you headed up or down? She asked. It's assumed in this territory that travelers are either headed up to Alaska or down from Alaska. Up. I could see that she was charmed by my brilliant conversational skills. Where in Colorado do you live? She glowed with a down-to-earth smile. Unfortunately, I took another bite of cheeseburger before answering. Bad timing. That's also on the list of stupid things a guy can do. Fort Collins, Colorado, I gulped. Sure, I know where Fort Collins is, she said. I grew up in Denver. God, she was beautiful. I took another bite of cheeseburger. Oh, no, I did it again. Denver, huh? Nice place. More brilliant dialogue. The older gentlemen set their coffee and rolls down at a nearby table. We just came up from Denver, she said. Actually, Dad came up from Florida just to make the drive with me. We love it. Dad? Of course it was her father. I should have noticed the resemblance. My mind shifted to warp speed. She likes motorcycles. She likes road trips. She's from Denver. She's got this wonderful country girl charm. Jesus, Jones, this was better than a B-grade movie. I gathered my composure and finally got my timing down so that I spoke first and chewed second. Florida, huh? I drove up from Key West. I'm headed to Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay, she said. Why in the world would you want to drive up there? Because it's as far as you can drive on this continent. I love road trips, she said, but you couldn't pay me to drive up there. My husband Dirk works up there part of the year, and he hates the drive. There's nothing north of Fairbanks. Husband? Did she say husband? My ears were ringing, and I felt dizzy. When I could focus again, I noticed the ring on her left hand. I hadn't seen it before because her hands were in her pockets. Damn. The nice ones always have husbands. I hated the son of a bitch. He's probably cheating on her. That's the way it always works. The nice ones all have assholes for husbands. After my mind slowed down, I realized that my imagination was ranting and raving about some jerk I knew nothing about. Uh-oh. Paranoia is another symptom of road fever. The conversation dwindled to some small talk about the Alcan, but I didn't hear much of it. When they got up to leave, the pretty woman stepped over to my table and said, "Be careful on your bike." Her comment was heartfelt and sincere. Why did she give a damn what I did on my bike? Why was she torturing me like this? I munched on my cheeseburger and said nothing. "My brother was killed on his motorcycle last year," she said, staring at me as though she were looking for her brother in my eyes. "Oh, I'm sorry," I said. "What happened?" "He was headed home from Alaska and hit a deer just outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The witnesses said he would have survived hitting the deer, but there was a car following his motorcycle too close. The car couldn't stop and ran over my brother. That's what killed him." "Wow, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say." "That's okay," she said. "My brother loved his motorcycles, and he sure loved to travel. He always said he'd die doing what he loved or else die from someone else's stupidity. The craziest thing is, he died from both." The ride back to Dawson Creek was the coldest, loneliest 60 miles I'll ever drive. I felt sorry for the girl because I'd reminded her of something that she had lost, and she had reminded me of something that I'd never found.
I hope you enjoyed Part 4 of Straight from the Road. Look for Part 5 in truck stops nationwide. Or send a check or money order for $5 to High Plains Publishing. 712 Winchester Drive, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80526.